really being very consistent with what he is saying. Because he really wants the people to repent and to live, not with the easy answers. Last time we had there, they would depend upon Egypt. Let Egypt be the power that would save them. And he says, that's foolishness. If you trust Egypt, everything will be ruined. Now try to get the idea that when it comes to these oracles against the heathen nations, and I put them down here, there's seven of them. Ammon, Moab, Edom, Philistia, Tyre, Sidon, Egypt. Is there any oracle against Nebuchadnezzar? No, that's Babylon, isn't it? There's nothing. Well, just as Jeremiah said, Nebuchadnezzar is at this point. He is not saying Nebuchadnezzar worshipped Marduk and we should worship Marduk or anything like that, but he's just talking about their own history and what God is going to do with his own people. Nebuchadnezzar is the servant of the Lord to bring the judgment upon his delinquent people. And the two, that's why I put them in capital letters here, the two big enemies of Nebuchadnezzar were the island, the Phoenician island of Tyre off the coast up here, even today, and Egypt. Those were the big enemies of Nebuchadnezzar. And the most oracles that we have, four of them against Tyre, and seven of them against Egypt. And seven means what? This is the Lord's doing. It isn't enough to have six. You got to have seven. And then you have completeness. Well, before I go into these, and we can't possibly take up this in detail, we're really only going to spend time looking at this one, and maybe a little here on this one, and at this one, the first one against Tyre, and the first one against Egypt, the crocodile of the Nile. That's what he calls it. It's like a crocodile, or like a hippopotamus that's down there in the marshes of the Nile, in the reeds and so forth. And then at the very end, we'll see this rather surprising one, where the Ezekiel changes the prophecy. He had promised over here that Tyre would be destroyed. Nebuchadnezzar came there and tried to destroy it. Well, he did succeed in taking the part of Tyre that was on the mainland, but when it came to the island, he didn't take it. That was only taken by Alexander 300 years later. not 300 years, about 200 years later. And in the 4th century, when Alexander came and made a causeway. And the causeway is still, so today it's, Tyre is not an island, it's a peninsula. But then he changed it and said, well, Nebuchadnezzar was my servant, and he worked very hard, and he didn't really get that city. I didn't give it to him. So I know what I'll give him. The laborer is worthy of his word. Isn't this interesting that the Lord says, I'll give him Egypt. And boy, that's worth a lot. All kinds of Tyres put together. And we'll read that, which is very surprising. And people who have a kind of a inflexible view of God, God can do what he wants to. He can change things upside down. I'm really surprised about this little section in chapter 29. I had one person in the other class, she was really quite concerned about this, that the Lord changed his mind. But doesn't the Lord sometimes change his mind? Didn't he say at the flood, I'm sorry I ever made creation, especially those humans, because they filled my creation with what? With violence. I made a big mistake. Isn't that a thing that he says a big mistake to make us free, that we can not only say yes to God, but that we can say no, and we can ruin his creation if he lets us. And so the Lord has to change, and this is a surprising sort of thing. That's why I find Ezekiel good, because first of all, Ezekiel is new to most people, and we don't have all the easy answers that we usually use to get rid of our problems, see? And when you face them straight on, just the way it is, you really kind of learn something. And that's why I find Ezekiel. And I find the people like this too. Now, before I go into that, I'd like to do something that we haven't done in this course. And that is to show you how the book of Ezekiel
its 48 chapters, is built up? Well, it's built up, first of all, in the first, hope I can get this here, with Duma results. That means where the prophet announces doom to the people. And I'll just, can everybody see this? I'll use this as a symbol, and I'll put down D just below it. Chapters 1 to 24 in Ezekiel are all full of doom oracles against God's own people. Their delinquency. They've broken the covenant, and so now this will be, it's going to be the end of their independence. By the way, it's not the end of him as a people or the end of his promises. But as far as Jerusalem is concerned, and imagine when you lose your capital city and you lose all your independence and lose your royal house and everything. That's tremendous. Most people don't survive when they have that. The Israelites did survive for other reasons. And then you have what we're going to look at right now from chapter 25 to 32. And I'll just use a different color and a different symbol. These dooms against the Gentiles, against the non-Israelites. And actually, in a way, this is for the Israelites to hear that these people are wicked and they're still his people. Israel is still his people, even though he's going to spank them and send them away into captivity and gird them. And this is a part that many people never look at. But I think we have to do it in the sort of study that we're doing here at Holden. And then I might say that you have a bunch of what we might call salvation oracles. See, I have a brighter color here. In 33 to 37. For instance, the dry bones one. You remember where the bones are dead and now they become alive? That's chapter 37. We did have yesterday, the day before that, we had chapter 34. And chapter 34 is about the shepherds and the good shepherd. Then, week and Thursday, I'll take up the famous Gog from Magog, you know, the final enemy. That's two chapters there. Everybody likes to talk about the end of the world. Well, here it is. What Ezekiel thinks when the final enemy gets it. And then finally he has, in the last one, and that I'll do in the very last part, his vision in nine chapters at the end of his book of the new temple, which is going to be pollution free. And when they get back and the Lord fulfills all of his promise, it's going to be great. It's going to be like in the book of Revelation where the heavenly Jerusalem comes from above and its 12 gates are made with pearls and all the rest of that for the 12 tribes and all that sort of thing. Now, so is everyone clear that this is what we're going to talk about today? All right, now let's ask this question. What kind of an attitude did Israelites have over against non-Israelites?
They were intolerant.
Pardon?
They were intolerant.
They were intolerant. Yes and no. Yes, basically, they had to stay to their own knitting. You're right. This is not yet New Testament. This is Old Testament. And by the way, it's still the stage in which Shamir and Menachem Begin and all the hardliners in Israel still live. Because for them, the Messiah has not yet come. For us as Christians, we're in a different ballgame. The Messiah has come. And that's quite different. You see that? So, especially to looking, if we compare it with our view, they are intolerant. You see that? But, and Ezekiel is really tough on any Israelite that would not take the Israelite faith seriously. He's really tough on them, you see that? But here's the question. Here's why I said no. He will have, as we'll see here, some salvation oracles for Egypt. Yes, enemy number one. And we'll say that in the latter days, the Lord will also include them in the good promises that God has for the future. So this, by the way, people often don't realize. And I can give you, as I will, we have enough time for that, parallels in Isaiah and in Jeremiah. So it isn't only in the New Testament where Jesus says, don't you remember that Syrophoenician woman? She was always going after to heal that his daughter and who had an unclean spirit, you know, and pestering the disciples, tried to get rid of her. And then he even said the first, well, I'm not sent to the except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And cut her off. And then she said, but don't the little puppy dogs that go into the palace, don't they get the crumbs from the palace? Can't you give a Gentile woman at least something? And then Jesus is amazed at her faith and says, she's only the first. Many will come from the east and the west and sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, when the children of the kingdom will be excluded, isn't it? And there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's Jesus himself. And after the resurrection, then what does Jesus say? Go into all the nations. And we're in that ball game, get the idea? But Ezekiel was not yet in that ball game, nor are present day Jews yet in that ball game. We have to try to understand them from their own viewpoint. But let me ask you this question. Do you think that Ezekiel was now sending ambassadors to go up here to Tyre, to that merchant city, Phoenician city, and try to convert those people to join the covenant? No, that's not the point. I doubt whether this message even ever got up there. This message is largely for his own people in exile, isn't it? So that they understand what God is doing with all nations. Because God is not just the God of Israel. What did the Lord say to Abram? In thee, Abram, and in thy seed, all the nations will be blessed. You see that? And when the Israelites worship in Jerusalem, and they're worshiping only the God who's revealed himself to them, Yahweh is his personal name, the Lord, they also know that eventually the Gentiles, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be the highest mountain, and all nations will flow to it, isn't it? And so when they worship, what do they ask that the Gentiles should also praise, even though they're only card-carrying Jews who are inside of that temple? You can't get in there if you're a Gentile. You know that there are Gentiles, and you call upon, don't you even call upon creation? The hills and the seas to clap their hands and to rejoice. So the faith of Israel is cosmic, you see that? And I'm kind of glad that we have this little section in Ezekiel. It wouldn't be right to give this series without including it. Now, let me say just a few things about oracles of doom against heathen nations. You perhaps all know the story that when the Israelites came up from Egypt through the desert, and they were going on this side from Egypt here, remember they were down at Mount Sinai, and they came up from this side, they had to pass through the land of Moab. And the king of Moab got somebody to curse him. Remember that? He went up there to a man by the name of Balaam, whose place at Deir Allah we have found archaeologically an extra-biblical confirmation of the biblical tradition. Anyway, he got him to come down and say, I'll pay a lot of money if you curse this people that's invading my country. And you remember the very interesting story, that each time when he opened his mouth to curse the God's people, what happened? It turned into a blessing. Well, the first time it happened, that king was angry. He said, look, I paid a lot of money invested in for you to curse people. Because that's what ancient people did. You see that? They had curses. And so he said, well, I think you're impressed just by their size. So we'll go to another part of the valley overlooking the camp of the Israelites, and they won't be so impressive, and he'll curse them. And the same thing happened. Happened a third time, then he was going to send him home. And the fourth time, without asking, then Balaam, the heathen prophet, instead of cursing Israel, talked about the Messiah. I'll see him, but not now. I'll behold him, but not nigh. A star, it's really a comet, will come out of Jacob. And it will smite. This is not only a comet, but it's like a scepter. It's the same word in Hebrew. That will smite Moab. And this is kind of the messianic idea. That the wise men, remember they came, they saw the star in the east, and they said what? We saw a star and we're coming to Jerusalem to see who that king is that's now born with the appearance of this supernova, this new star. And that was a kind of surprising sort of thing. So the idea was very common in ancient Near East of having heathen nations cursed. The Romans, they wouldn't start a war against the neighbors, the Sabines in the hills there, unless they first opened the door of the temple of the god of Janus and the god of Mars of war, and then they shot arrows there, then only could they shed blood. They had all their prophets and so forth. So this is a common sort of thing, and everywhere we expect that if you had to deal with nations, especially with wars, that you would do that. Now, the Israelite prophets, the prophets that we have in our Bible, they did this. Perhaps the best example, many of you know this, is Amos. Amos, one of the predecessors of Ezekiel, he was a prophet to the northern kingdom up here, Israel. That's before it was destroyed. And when, maybe I can read it right from chapter 1 of Amos itself. He got in the city square of the capital city, Samaria, up north, and this is what he said to the people. And I might say the people liked it at first. For three transgressions of Damascus, he must have turned in the direction of Damascus up here. And he says, I got three things against him, I even got four things. I got any number of things against him. I'll not revoke his punishment. For they have threshed Gilead. They came down here with threshing sledges of iron, all kinds of atrocities. They ripped up pregnant women to take out the fetuses, the unborn. They took their chariots and drove them over wounded soldiers and all kinds of atrocities. And so they're going to get, what, judgment. Then you know what Amos did? He turned in the other direction and he went down toward the city of Gaza, down here, one of the Philistine cities, and they had sold people into slavery and had not obeyed the covenant of brotherhood, made slaves out of captives. And you can't do that. So you can see there is such a thing as international law. And there is such a thing that God says you can't just do that. Then he looked up to the very cities that we talked about, Tyre and Sidon, we'll hear about Phoenicia, and he said too, they misused their wealth from their trade and their merchandise in order to enslave people and oppress them. Then he went down to these Edomites way down here, and they were the camel merchants from Petra and so forth, and they also misused their wealth and their power. The Moabites even fought against their neighbors. They opened their graves and burned the bones of captives and desecrated even the dead. You can't do that. And then he went against Ammon. Then he went against Judah. And each time the people said, give it to them, especially those commies up there in Syria, in Damascus. And they were really happy. And when he went to the people down here in Judah, he said, yes, they think they're so proud that they got the temple down there and they're Orthodox and they make fun of us up here in North. Give it to them, Amos. But you know what Amos did in his last one?
Israel.
Yes, he dropped the bomb right on top of Israel. Let me read that. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel, the people, I think this must have gone over like a lead balloon. They clapped when they got it to everybody else, but for three transgressions of Israel, for I'll not revoke its punishment, because they sell the righteous for a silver and the needy for a pair of shoes. They trample on the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and turn aside the way of the afflicted. A man and his father go into the same maiden. That was kind of their sacred prostitution. And they went to the pawn shops, and when people couldn't pay, they took advantage of them as the pawn dealers do. People who have property take advantage of other people. And you remember in the Bible it says in the Constitution of Israel, Exodus chapter 21, that if you take in pledge from your neighbor his garment, his outer, we'd say, coat, kind of like a sleeping bag, and don't give it back by the time the sun goes down, and he gets cold at night, and he cries unto me, I have sensitive ears, and I will hear. You have to give it back by the time the sun goes down, isn't it? You couldn't take property, and you couldn't fleece people that way. You couldn't have usury among your own people. That was very strong. Israelites, it's in the Bible, but they didn't always want to hear it. And so this is a very good example. By the way, does it show, too, that he is not really playing favorites? These prophets, every nation, including God's own nation, lives in front of the presence of God. And you can't play tricks with him, you see that. You would find the same thing if you wanted to look in the book of the prophet Isaiah. The first whole section, largely do miracles, so some stories about Isaiah. And then in his chapter 13 to 23, you'll have all kinds of dooms against the heathen nations. You'd find the same thing in the book of Jeremiah. I think in there it comes in the latter part, I think from chapter 45 to 51. You have all kinds of oracles. So this is rather surprising, and we find that here too. I might say that the prophets are to me something, I may use this example in the last session, like if we at Holden Village here had, we have an avalanche danger with snow here, of course, that's known, but if we really had a fault up there and we were living in the village here and people warned all the directors that that rock up there is really not, it's loose and it's going to come down with some rumble and destroy all the people living down here. And they told that to one director, and he listened to another director and another director, and he wouldn't do that. That's the way the prophets did. They all said, this people has lost its basis in what? God's covenant. And therefore, it will be destroyed. Amos is the first one. He says, use the words, Cates, the end of my people has come. But nobody wanted to believe it. Isaiah said the same thing. Jeremiah says the same thing. Ezekiel says the same thing. But the funny thing is that after the avalanche occurred, who had a real message for the people? These very same prophets. Because they had a message that was centered in God, the Lord, the one true God, and they would also have salvation prophecies. And that's what is interesting. So as we go through these, I think we'll be able to understand this a little more. One final thing. These prophecies against Egypt are, as I kind of mentioned, this is the 10th year. This one comes out of place. That's the one where he changed his mind, the 17th year. It was 52 years he changed and went back and changed it. The rest of them are all just before or just after Jerusalem was destroyed, because that was about a year and a half siege. So it'll be the 10th year, the 11th year, the 12th year. And I might say that we have two sad things here. At the end of chapter in 33, you have the death of Isaiah's wife, I mean Ezekiel's wife. Also, it really occurs here. And so you have the passage in chapter 20, way over here in 24, that the Lord is going to take away the pride of his eyes. And in one way it seems to be the holy city of Jerusalem. In one way it's his wife. It's actually both. But you can't lament it. Now could you imagine that a man would have his wife die and he couldn't have a funeral for it? Instead of doing what they always did when a person died, somehow you had to go barefoot and you had to have your head bare. He had to keep on his shoes and a turban in his head. And when you had a death in the family, you had to put something in your mouth, and he had to do the opposite. And the people were outraged, and they said in that little town, Tel Aviv, why do you do that? And then he said, yes, the pride of his eye, the delight of his heart, had died. That's not only his wife, Jerusalem. The same day his wife dies when Jerusalem is taken. Can you imagine that? Remember, he's the guy that has all these visions, and what he sees in Jerusalem is very clear to him. And so there, he's in a room. He doesn't talk to anybody. He's quiet. Until, and that's told here in chapter 33, a refugee comes to give eyewitness report of the destruction of Jerusalem to these refugees there in Babylon. And this Polite says, yes, the city has been destroyed. Then the Lord opens his mouth, and from that time forth, he's a prophet of salvation. Isn't that surprising? But what we have here, therefore, when it's put here, all these things come. So at the end you have the death of Jerusalem and the fall of Jerusalem, the death of his wife here, and the fall of Jerusalem here. And we have this purposely put there. Who do you think put this all together? You see, when I write a book, well, I have to type it up, you know, and send it to the publisher. And if they accept it, then it goes through all the rigmarole. It's printed, isn't it? And then Augsburg Publishing House, and the date is put on, and it's copyright, and all the rest of that, and it's in print. But they wrote books, didn't they? Yeah, do you think that he wrote it all down right after he said it? Maybe, maybe not.
Pardon? What people they call scribes.
Yes, I think he went to temple school. He's extremely learned. So I think he himself could write. Although, in the case of Jeremiah, Jeremiah didn't write. He dictated to Baruch. And we don't hear of a scribe in the connection with Ezekiel. In fact, didn't some of you were here when we had the first lesson, chapter 1, when the hand of the Lord came from heaven, it was with a written scroll. And he had to get the word of God and eat it. Tasted terrible. so much. Not just because of papyrus, it had so many bad oracles in it. But as soon as he got it inside and made it his own, it became sweet as honey. And he is much nicer than we think. But you see, underneath this surface, this hard surface, you know people like that, don't you? That they're very passionate. And there's really much more love than the people who are gush over at you when you first meet them and later turn out to be the very opposite. And Ezekiel, I think, is more the first time than the last type. He's doing this. Well, enough of that. We'll begin. I have to watch my time here. Why don't you turn not to 26, but Ezekiel chapter 27. The only reason why I'm trying that is because we're going to take up the just one oracle in detail. That'd be chapter 26. But we have to look at chapter 27 because it gives us a very beautiful description of the city of Tyre. Some of you may know this from history, but Tyre and Sidon, the Phoenicians, they brought the alphabet to the Greeks. They were the great traders. They established Carthage, you know, the great city in the North African coast in modern-day Tunis, and went up then to Sardinia, that island off of Italy, and then they had colonies. They went all the way to Spain, to Tarshish. And they were very important. It was just my good fortune to have been in my last sabbatical, I was able to get to Venice, where they had an international an exhibit sponsored by the Fiat Motor Company. And they had one whole room that had to do with Ezekiel, this is chapter 27, with all this stuff that he mentions on the great ship of Tyre. As I told you, Tyre is not only the mainland, but if they lost the mainland, they could always go out to the island. You see that? And so they just said, we're impregnable. And they were, really, until Alexander got there. And even though Nebuchadnezzar took the mainland, he never took the actual island itself. And that's quite clear in the book of, well, from history and the book of... Now, in chapter 27, we have what John Milton called the perfect ship of Tyre. John Milton, as a young, brilliant Cambridge student, as before he went blind, studied Hebrew and all these things, he made his own version of it. And the Lord came to me, now you, son of man, raise a lamentation over Tyre, and say to Tyre, who dwells at the entrance to the sea, merchant of the peoples on many coastlands, thus says the Lord God. O Tyre, you who said, I am perfect in beauty. Your borders are at the heart of the sea. Your billows made perfect your beauty. And now it describes all the parts of this beautiful ship, the great ship Tyre, made from timbers, the precise wood, carpenters among you would really know this much better than I, what are used to make this perfect city, this perfect ship? They made all your planks of the fir trees from Sinai, that's Mount Hermon near Lebanon. They took a cedar from Lebanon to make a mast for you. Oaks of Bashan, that's out there west of Mount Lebanon, they made your oars. They made your deck of pines from the coast of Cyprus, inlaid with ivory. A fine embroidered linen from Egypt was your sail, serving as your ensign. Blue and purple from the coasts of Elisha, that's one of the Phoenician cities. By the way, the purple dye came from a little sea creature that they would take, a kind of a murex, they call it. Like we'd say a crab, you see that. And they took that out and they used that for dye. And it was so precious that only a nobility could wear purple. You maybe know the Roman senators could have a purple fringe around their togas, and that's the idea. And so they had a monopoly on that. And this was your awning. And verse 8, the inhabitants of Sidon and Arvad, these are also Phoenician cities, were your rowers. Skilled men of Zimmer, also a city there, although we don't know all these places, were in you. They were your pilots. The elders of Gebel, another Phoenician city, and her skilled men were with you, caulking your seams. All the ships of the sea with their mariners were within you to barter for your wares. Then he mentions the mercenary sailors that are rowing in the boats and that are kind of the military people. Then look at verse 12. It says Tarshish. Remember, that's Spain. And what do they get from Spain? Well, all kinds of things. Silver, iron, tin, lead. On one of the slides that I showed earlier this week from the National Geographic, they had the copper ingots. Remember, archaeologically, some of you have seen this in the National Geographic. Haven't they found such boats like this? And you'll see beautiful reconstructions of what they found down in the hold. And these Phoenicians traded with all of them. So this is a beautiful description. In fact, this description from the prophet Ezekiel is the best one we have from antiquity of trading anywhere. That's why when they had this exhibit that I saw there in the Grossi Palace in Venice, they had that on the wall, and I was so happy to see that. And they had examples of the Phoenician trades, the things that were traded all over. All bronze and all kinds of things. Notice they have got horses, war horses, mules, they had everything. Doesn't happen to mention slave girls. They did that too.
They had persons of men.
Yes, persons of men, you're right, yeah. So they did trade with slaves, and I can't possibly talk about everything they trafficked in. Look at verse 18 as an example. Damascus trafficked with you for your abundant goods because of your great wealth of every kind. Wine of Helmon, white wool, wine from Ozel, they exchanged for your wares. Wrought iron, cassia, calamus were bartered for your merchandise. And he mentions all the places down in Arabia. He mentions all the places way up in what is now Turkey. And it's just a tremendous thing. And by the way, there, at this point, there's nothing wrong in Tyre. When we get to chapter 26, he'll mention that. The only thing that's wrong with this ship, it doesn't have any rotting in it, is the first words that we said. He says, I am perfect, isn't it? Isn't that how he says? I'm the best ship. And there'll never be a shipwreck. I am perfect in beauty, isn't it? But it doesn't go too far. In a way, shouldn't the ship be nice? Mm-hmm. And in a way, Ezekiel here shows a good side of himself. He's not quite intolerant. In fact, you can see he kind of enjoys that, isn't it? Isn't that nice to go down to a harbor and to see all the stuff that comes in? I once took a tour of the German harbor, the German city of Hamburg, and I was amazed. All the stuff, it was an excellent tour that comes into a great harbor city like that. And it's just tremendous. And so Ezekiel likes that. I'll just have to finish this up by looking at verse 25. So you were filled and heavily laden in the heart of the seas. Verse 26, your rowers have brought you out to the high seas. But then what happens? The east wind has wrecked you. So you see there's doom. You see that? In the hearts of the seas. And verse 28 and 29, the survivors, when a ship goes down in the harbor, what happens? Well, they cry. Everybody cries bloody murder, isn't it, to come and save them. the sound of the cry of your pilots, the countryside shakes, and down from their ships come all that handle the oar. The mariners and all the pilots of the sea stand on the shore, and they wail over you, and they cry bitterly that the ship has gone down, and try to save the survivors. And verse 32, in their wailing they raise a lamentation for you and lament over you and say, who has ever destroyed like Tyre in the midst of the sea? And so forth. But that's all we need to look there. Now, let's get to the section that we have to do. And would you mind, is it Lois?
Uh-huh.
Would you mind reading the very chapter 26? We just read parts of this. We've got 15 26. Minutes, so we can do this quite well.
Mm-hmm. Chapter 26?
Yes, chapter 6, 26 went against this prosperous island city, Tyre. You see that? Verses 1 and maybe 2 to begin with.
In the 11th year, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, because Tyre said concerning Jerusalem, aha, the gate of the peoples is broken. It has swung open to me. I shall be replenished, and that she is laid waste.
Yes, I shall be replenished now that she has been laid waste. So they said, ah, oh, that's good that Nebuchadnezzar is going to knock Jerusalem out. That means what? We will get all the gate is open to us. We'll have all the monopoly on the merchants, and we'll get richer and richer and richer. You see that? And does Ezekiel like that? No, you don't respect Jerusalem, and even you Gentiles ought to respect the Jews. You see what I'm saying? I don't say that Menachem Begin is right, and I have an independent view on that whole political thing. You do what you have to do on that. I joined that little group called the Palestinians, Jews, and others, Christians, for justice in Palestine. That's a little group. It's in a Haddock group in Tacoma. And we talk with Jews, including those in the synagogue, and say, just like the German Christians should have taken care of the excesses and the injustices in Germany, so you Jews should take care of the injustices that are suffering, the Palestinians are suffering. And talk great. It's very interesting. When in that group we get the Palestinians, some who during the Gulf War were standing up for Saddam Hussein. And we said, heavens no on that. And so it's a very interesting if you ever involve yourself. By the way, don't be afraid to involve yourself in such things. You learn a tremendous amount. You don't have to know
what it was called?
Pardon?
What did you say it was called? Your group?
Palestinians, Jews, and others.
Oh, I see.
That means Christians. a Jewish gave his name to it, but I wouldn't object to it. It isn't one of these things that I have to attend all the meetings, although I've done it a couple of times, you see that, especially during that crisis. And what they do, they'll have Israeli songs and they'll have a party and dances and the same time Palestinian ones, you know, to get to know them as people, you see that? But if you want to know where there's trouble, that's in all the synagogues today, in Tacoma Synagogue, because, you know, when Congressman Dix gets his money, where does he get it? From the great big contributors in the Jewish community. There's a tremendous amount. Oh yeah, we know all of that stuff. That's part of our job as being a kind of an advocacy group. Now I'm not saying that you people must be advocacies. I do think that all Christians must be concerned. And we have to be very careful here that you don't make fun out of the trouble of Israel. And you see what I'm getting at? And realize that they are hanging on by their teeth. That's the way they feel. We think, oh, they're smart, they got all of our money, and they can shoot down those Arabs anytime. But that's not the way it looks to them. They are surrounded by 100 million Arabs, you see that? And if they don't get the help that they need now for this new technological age from George Bush, and Jared Bush says, no, you can use that money, but you can't use it to put, contrary to all armistice agreements, settlements where? In the occupied territories. Do you see that? Now, what you write to your congressman, and I don't know whether you have to write to him. You certainly have to pray to God about this. That's up to you. But I'm just saying that this is one of these things. Isn't that saying, didn't Tyre said, isn't that good? Nebuchadnezzar is going to go down here and knock off Jerusalem, and then we'll have more trade, isn't it? Okay, read verses 3 and following for maybe 3 through 7, okay?
3 through 7?
Yes, mm-hmm. Verse 3, start there. Mm-hmm. Just where you left off.
Where did I leave off?
You left off at verse 2. So now if you take verse 3.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I did. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Tyre, and I will bring up many nations against you, as the sea brings up its waves. They shall destroy the walls of Tyre and break down her towers, and I will scrap her soil from her and make her a bare rock. She shall be in the midst of the sea, a place for the spreading of net. For I have spoken, says the Lord God, and she shall become a spoil to the nations, and her daughters and the mainland shall be slain to the sword. Then they will know that I am the Lord.
All right, so you can see that here he's giving them a real promise of destruction. Look at verse 7. I'll just read myself here, just scattered verses so we finish on time. Behold, I will bring upon Tyre from the north Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of kings, with horses and chariots and horsemen and a host of many soldiers. Earlier this week I had some slides and had one from the National Geographic which showed him just doing that. Or verse 14, I'll be very important. I will make you a bare rock, and you shall never be rebuilt. Verse 16. Then all the princes of the sea will step down from their thrones and remove their robes and strip off their embroidered garments, lamenting, how have you vanished from the sea, O city renowned, who imposed your territory on all the mainland. Verse 18. Now the isles tremble on the day of your fall. Everybody said, oh, could that great city have fallen? Great Berlin is nothing but ruins. Yeah. And now what happens, verse 20, I like this. Tyre descends down to the underworld, where Ezekiel says the old Assyrian empire is there, the old Elamite empire, and Togarmath, that was a Turkish empire was down there, and they're all down in the underworld. See, they don't quite have the idea that we, since the resurrection of Jesus, have of heaven and hell, but they still have the people who are down there in the old graves down below, moaning and waiting, waiting for the final things. But here, look at verse 20. Tyre is descending into the underworld. So I will thrust you down with those that descend to the pit, to the people of old, and I'll make you to dwell in the netherworld among primeval ruins with those who will go down to the pit, so that you will not have a place in the land of the living. This, ladies and gentlemen, was not fulfilled. At least only partially fulfilled as far as the mainland is concerned. Isn't that surprising? Ezekiel said it, didn't he? He's very clear. And he gives a date when he said it. And then later on he's going to change it. But we'll have to leave that until, let's take the first of these Egyptian oracles in Ezekiel 29. And just to save time and finish on time, I'll read it myself if you don't mind. This is against the Nile dragon, the crocodile Egypt. And I think you'll kind of like this, even though it's kind of naughty. you can realize that this guy, I called him last time a cartoonist, you see that? He's a bit of an extremist, and he doesn't mind getting it. But that's how you learn, isn't it? I had a preacher once, and a pastor of my congregation, he always got kind of mixed up, but he was the most interesting preacher. The other preacher, they had two of them, and most people liked the one that was not mixed up. But I think we learned not more about the one who got mixed up. Actually, he was suffering from a heart attack, you know, and other things, and so, in a way, he was not incompetent. It was just a problem, see? Like, I remember once he compared the death of Stalin, who died at the time, to the death that they had of a lady in our own congregation. And I thought it was marvelous. Most of the people thought he was a little off the beam. But he made people think. You see that? Okay. chapter 29, verse 1. In the 10th year of the 10th month on the 12th day, so January 7th, 587. So this is after Jerusalem it's just before Jerusalem is being besieged. Then it's just about to come. The word of the Lord came to me, verse 2, Son of man, set your face against Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So now Egypt's going to get it, see? Say, thus saith the Lord, behold, I'm against you, you great dragon that lies in the midst of the stream that says, my Nile is my own, I made it. So you see, a monotheistic God says there can't be any other gods. And wasn't the world full of all kinds of idols and other gods like this? So you can't say that is all right. And now, here comes the big accusation. Remember, they don't just sap the nations, they tell the reasons. And one of the big reasons against Egypt is that it was tempting Israel to false trust. And so look what it says here, verse 4 and following. I'll put hooks in your jaws. I'll draw you up out of the midst of your streams. Imagine kind of getting that crocodile out there. And to the beasts of the earth and to the birds I have given you as food. You know, he's a carcass. You see that? He's dead. And all the scavenger birds come and the beasts come. Verse 6, because you have been a staff of reeds to the house of Israel. That's a quotation from Isaiah chapter 36. When they leaned upon you, you broke and tore off their shoulders. It was bad to lean on you. You're a terrible temptation to them. Verse 8, therefore, behold, I will bring a sword upon you. The land of Egypt shall be a desolation and a waste. And now, be very careful in the next part. I'll read it and you tell me what's happening. Verse 13 and 14 and 15 and 16. At the end of 40 years, I will gather the Egyptians from the peoples among whom they were scattered. And I'll restore the fortunes of Egypt and bring them back into the land of Peth, that's in Upper Egypt, a land of their origin. And they shall be a lowly kingdom, not a superpower anymore, but a lowly kingdom. 15. It shall be most lowly of the kingdoms, never again rule over the nations. 16. It shall never again be the reliance of the house of Israel. So Israel won't be tempted to trust it, recalling their iniquity when they turn to them for aid. Then they will know that I am the Lord God. And I think that these prophets are right on. They're much better than the politicians of the day. The politicians always messed it up because what? They had false gods. Whereas the prophets, over the long haul, even though during the time when they said it they wouldn't listen to them, they really proved to be very nice. Now, in the last short time that we have left, let's take the next one. Notice it comes from the 17th year. And it's been inserted later. Do you see that? And somehow, this good man Ezekiel, God bless him for being honest. Too many people, when they have a problem like this, a discrepancy, they like to push it over, isn't it? He does not. Nor does the Lord. Which is surprising. We're dealing with the living God. He's faithful to his word, the first word, in the way Tyre got it. You see that? But he's also what? Flexible to deal with the realities of, well, humans. You see, the Lord is really in trouble. He never should have made us. He should have made puppets. And then we would do it. But to make creatures that can say no to him. My gosh, wouldn't you rather be a puppet? Alan, you like to be as naughty as you are.
I'd like to
just
figure it out for myself.
Watch out.
Watch out.
Okay, let's look at this one. In the 27th day of the first month, of the first day, April 26th, 571, the word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, made his army labor hard against Tyre. Every head was made bald and every shoulder was rubbed bare. Yet neither he nor his army got anything from Tyre to pay for the labor that he had performed against it. And the Lord has a responsibility of doing what? The labor is worthy of his reward. Isn't that interesting? So what is the Lord going to do and give to his deputy as a substitute for what he didn't give? Verse 19, therefore behold, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will give the land of Egypt to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Egypt. He shall carry off its wealth and despoil it and plunder, and it shall be the wages for his army. I will give him the land of Egypt as a recompense for which he labored, because he worked for me, says the Lord. Isn't that marvelous? So this guy is really interesting. And now, verse 21, on that day I shall call a horn to spring forth in the house of Israel. The idea of horn is often in the Bible. It means the strength, usually. Isn't that, you know, the one where they fight and it's a sign of strength? And I will open your lips, he's talking to Ezekiel, among them, and they will know that I am the Lord. So it's too bad that Alpha left here, but I was going to ask him, you still think he's intolerant? Well, he is to a certain extent.
Yes.
And I think we have to. Wasn't Jesus intolerant? Everybody thinks he was so sweet, but so I noticed that he went into the temple when people got in the way of establishing the kingdom, and he just upset those tables, and he took a whip, and he had muscular Christianity. Everybody says, you can't do that. Well, he did. That's why I find the Bible extremely interesting. And I find Ezekiel especially really very interesting. Well, we have 1 minute, yeah. Who wants to say something? I monopolized on much of it. But it's your fault because you all listen. See, I can tell that, you know, if you're quizzical and you're wondering, or you don't smile, or it takes a long time for you to smile, I can tell that. But any comments? Yes?
You certainly interested me in studying more about Ezekiel.
Well, yes. One of the things I said I would do in my retirement is to rehabilitate Ezekiel among my people whom I taught. So I have a number of Bible classes in my own parish, Trinity in Tacoma, and elsewhere. I went up to Belfair, Washington, had a weekend with them, and I'm glad to do that. Ordinarily, I sing in our church choir. I can preach, but I don't like to, because I think a preacher has to be 7 days a week living with the people to whom he preaches, and then he can preach. But and professors can do that. I'll do it if I have to. Oh yes. I really do like to do that. So, and I would recommend highly. It's unfortunately that the people bought up all the copies. We had, I guess, 8 copies of this in the bookstore.
Would that be available like at an Augsburg show?
Well, I think if you ask for it, I'll put the name here. It's Peter Kirby. He was a professor up at the University of Alberta in Calgary, and of Bible. They had a department of religion. He was also the dean of the humanities, and it's simply called Ezekiel, and it's in a wonderful Bible series called the Daily Study Bible Series. This is published by Westminster Press, and so you can simply get it, and it's really, I recommend it very, very highly. So if you want to continue your studies on your own, William Barclay started this series, The Old Scotchman, and now the Presbyterians, they're all Presbyterians kind of leading this, they're publishing houses like we have Oxford. We have some good things too, but this, of those that are available for people, I kind of delight this very much. And you can read, and you will find it very edifying. And you can learn from these prophets. What is nice about it is that we know so many other things about and have heard Isaiah so much. I still think Isaiah is tops. But when I was teaching, for instance, I really had to make my students find Isaiah when he meant what he meant there. But he is an egghead. He went to Harvard. He is intellectual. He says it only once. Here Ezekiel hammers it away. You can't get away from it. He's a kind of extremist. And since we're a bit kookish ourselves, we like a kookish prophet, you see that? That's why he catches on. So a little problem there. He's the only prophet, you see that. But I think he has an awful lot to say. And so I'm very happy to teach you. If there are some things you still want to talk to me about, I'm continue 5 days next week, so you better change all your plans and stay. No, you can study Ezekiel on your own.
Thank you.
Thank you.